This episode of Standard Orbit is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for your tablet, smartphone, and desktop. Support the show and get a free audiobook of your choice by visiting audibletrial.com/trekfm.
Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Follow a Standard Orbit, Mr. Chekhov, and take us home.
Hi, sir.
It is the word of Landru.
Joy to you, friends, and thanks for joining us here in Standard Orbit, Trek FM's dedicated show to the original series. My name is Drew, or Landru, and this is my co-host Mike from Commentary Trek Stars.
Hey, what's up?
Well, today we're going to do our last interview ever. Well, on Standard Orbit 1.0. Yeah. But this is the final word. This is going to be it. It's what we're going to talk about on Phase 2. And to talk about Phase 2 with us, we have Ben Robinson.
How's it going, Ben?
It's good. It's good. It's a nice dark Sunday afternoon here in London.
All right. Yeah. Thank you very much for joining us. Now, for people who may not be familiar with you, I'm sure they're familiar with your work. You know, in addition to doing the Star Trek magazine back in the aughts, you know, mm-hmm. which was a great magazine. You're also the guy responsible for all of these amazing Eagle Moss starships, which everyone is obsessed with because they're awesome.
Oh, well, that's very kind of you to say so.
Yes.
But yeah, that is, I am that guy. Before that, I was one of the launch editors on the Star Trek Back Files, which I think some people know about in the US, certainly was a big thing in the UK and even in Japan. And I wrote a couple of Haynes manuals as well. I did the Enterprise and the Klingon Bird of Prey Haynes manuals.
Cool.
So I've done my time.
and one of your passions inside the world of Star Trek is Phase 2,
yeah.
The series that never was, right?
Yes. I mean, actually, or Star Trek 2, as it was just known back then.
Oh, really?
Yeah, well, wow. They didn't call it Phase 2 back then. It was because they just thought 2 was perfectly reasonable because there wasn't a movie that would be confusing. In fact, I think it probably would have just been called Star Trek. The scripts have a little Roman numeral 2 on them, and that's what all the memos say. But I guess they just called it Star Trek.
I guess that makes sense. I mean, that's what they did with Mission Impossible, right?
Yeah, why not?
When they relaunched it, they just called it Mission Impossible. Yeah, I guess that's true. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay, for those people who aren't familiar with what Star Trek II was going to be, like, what was it? You know, I mean, just basically speaking, what was it?
Well, so Star Trek gets cancelled in 1969, and then it goes into reruns, and people start watching it, and it becomes this phenomenon, becomes a big deal. And Paramount become interested in making more Star Trek because it's in syndication, it's doing really well, but there are only 79 episodes, which is low for syndication, and it's, you know, it's this big deal. So they're thinking about making more Star Trek, and they keep going back and forth about whether they're going to make a new TV show, whether they're going to make movies. You know, this is all in the mid-70s, I guess. Gene had been off and had made a couple of other things at Warner Brothers, so that's a bit of Planet Earth and Genesis 2, and neither of which had really got anywhere. He'd been resistant to doing more Star Trek, I think. He kind of felt that was over and it was time to move on and do other things. But people keep coming back to him and saying, we want to do more, we want to do more. And eventually, in about 1976, 77, there's a decision made that they're going to make a TV show. There've been a couple. I think you guys have talked about the fact that there've been various attempts to make movies, and there are some really interesting people involved in those movies, like Ken Adam. And you know, there are great Ken Adam sketches for one of the movies. But anyway, they decide in 77, that 78, that they're going to make this Star Trek TV show. And Gene assembles a writing staff that basically consists of him, Harold Livingston, who went on to work on Star Trek The Motion Picture, but there are reasons for that. It's really because he was working on a TV show. And Gene's kind of personal assistant at the time, John Povell, steps up to become the kind of Dorothy Fontana, if you will, of this show, the story editor.
Hmm.
And they get pretty far into making the show. They cast it, they build sets, they commission scripts, they have pitches, and they're absolutely ready to go when Paramount made the decision after Star Wars that actually they want to make a movie after all.
All right. So, okay, there's a lot there.
It was a kind of complicated question.
No. Yeah, for sure. And it's a complicated time, as we've learned, you know, over the past few weeks. But, okay, so in terms of, like, the concept of the show, like, the actual, like, show pitch, I guess, if you will, it was basically, as I understand it, kind of like Star Trek the Motion Picture, the TV show, right? I mean, kind of like that era, that sort of...
I think it's actually probably more accurate to say that it's season four.
Okay,
it's
all
like
right.
Season four of the original series. I think the budget would have been more like the budget for a TV show, not the massive budget that Star Trek The Motion Picture ended up having. It certainly wouldn't have been directed by Robert Wise. And had the most expensive special and visual effects in history at the time. So it's a much more modest proposition. It's updated, but it's probably the best way of thinking about it is that it's season four of the original series.
Okay. All right.
And when you look at the really early stuff that I've been looking at recently, they are still hoping that they're going to get Leonard Nimoy to come back and be Spock. So there are pitches for the stories that have Spock in them. And then that becomes apparent that that's not going to happen because Leonard has other things that he wants to do and this isn't a compelling enough offer to make him step away from them.
So originally it was going to be sort of more along the lines of just like getting the whole crew back together and it being its thing. And then when Nimoy steps away, is that when they added like Deckard and Ilea?
Deckard and Ilea, interestingly, Ilea actually, the name Elia, as opposed to Ilea, is actually the name of the young Vulcan. In the really early things. So they have this idea that there's going to be a young commander, a kind of a Riker, if you will, a Decker Riker character. And John Povel told me the reason for that was because the network was worried that at 40, Shatner was too old. Isn't that shocking? that's kind of mad. But there's a concern that Shatner at 40, 41, I guess, is an old man to be an action hero, which is just unbelievable now. It's like kind of Mad Men territory. And then the other thing, I guess, this is true, and I don't know whether anyone's actually, no one's ever confirmed this to me, but David Gerrold had written World of Star Trek, in which he points out that one of the big logical flaws in Star Trek is that the captain just goes down to the planet and leaves the ship in the hands of whoever happens to be standing around that week. And that actually there ought to be a kind of chief scout character who either is the deputy captain on the ship and has the experience or leads the landing parties. So I think the idea of introducing a kind of good-looking young lead kind of young Kirk type character comes from those two places. And again, in the early drafts, he's actually just called the young commander. You've got whole pitches which just say the young commander does this or does that. And then he becomes Adams for a while in some of these pitch documents. And then finally Decker, who is obviously meant to be Matt Decker's son from the Doomsday Machine. Though not all of the writers who were pitching seem to have understood that, because there's one story involving his father who is someone totally different.
Oh, well.
So they're there. And then I think that they probably had always wanted to introduce more attractive women. I think that was something that was always high on Gene's list of things to put in a TV show.
What?
Yeah, you can't imagine. I mean, what? And it's, you know, it's also a more feminist era where it seems a little strange, perhaps, that Star Trek didn't have a significant female character in the original series. So yeah. They introduce the character, this alien navigator, Ilea, who is from the pictures, no one seems to know much more about her apart from she has some kind of telepathic powers. I mean, if you think Deanna Troi, but doing Chekhov's job, then you're going to get pretty close to where you are, where you'd expect to be. And everybody else is back. Chapel's become a doctor. But everybody, and Chekhov has become head of security. A role that didn't really exist before. And everybody else is doing exactly what you'd expect them to do. So you've got Sulu, you've got McCoy, you've got Scotty. The only thing you don't have is Spock, which is obviously quite a big deal.
But wasn't there a young Vulcan science officer to take his place?
Absolutely. So this, to me, is the most important thing about this TV show as to whether it would have worked or not, is how good this character, Zon, would have been. So, and I find Zon is like, for me, he's like the great lost character of Star Trek. He's envisaged by Gene Roddenberry. He's cast by Gene Roddenberry. They actually cast this actor, David Gautreau, who goes through all the audition process. And there are, I think on some of the DVDs, you'll find the Blu-rays now. You can see his audition to play Zon. He wouldn't have had the kind of hair that he has in the audition. He hadn't had his hair cut to Vulcan style. But he's meant to be this 22-year-old Vulcan straight out of the academy who looks a bit like Michael York. And he's a full Vulcan. And they're obviously trying to say, well, look, we can't just replace Spock with another Spock. So we have to come up with a way of doing Spock that's different. So he's younger, he's a full Vulcan, and he's kind of got this kind of proto Data thing about him, because he realizes that in order to serve on a ship of humans, he's going to have to try and understand emotion. So he's trying to experiment with emotion, and there are scenes where he's like practicing laughing or smiling. He's trying to see why a joke is funny, and he doesn't get it. So there's quite a lot of Data in this character. But he's also got this fantastic sort of Spock kind of air of superiority as well. When I interviewed David Gautreau, who's a really he's a good interviewee, has a lot to say, and he's really interesting, and I think it's a great pity that we never got to see him. And I always think that they should just have cast him as a guest character on one of the shows, and I'm always amazed that they didn't.
Doesn't he have like a really small role in the motion picture? Like, isn't he like one of the guys at the beginning?
He's
like
Commander
that?
Branch. So when they get the message from Epsilon 9 that Norman Vija is approaching, that's David.
Okay, all right.
But he has a lot of very interesting things to say about being cast. He said he'd never really watched Star Trek. He was straight out of acting school, or even just out of college, I'm not sure. So he's like 21 or 22, and he's got this person. He hasn't even got a proper agent. He's got someone who can get him into these auditions, and he goes for these auditions, and he suddenly starts to realize as this carries on that like everybody in Hollywood, every hot young actor in Hollywood is auditioning for this role. And he says he's never watched Star Trek, so he doesn't really get what a big deal it is. And then he gets it. And he's cast. And, you know, he gets fitted for costumes, and he has conversations with Gene Roddenberry about how it's going to work and all of these things. And he told me this fantastic thing, saying, you know, he was really worried about how do you play a character who is unemotional. He's saying, what as an actor am I going to do here? I don't want to just be a robot. And he said that someone, I'm not sure if it was Gene, said to him, you have to imagine, I think it was his acting teacher, said that you know, imagine that it's like a record player and that the humans are all stuck in the wrong groove. So ever you try and talk to them, you're trying to shift them over to the right groove. So I try and, you know, they just don't get it. And you're trying to explain it to them in some way. So, you know, I think that's really interesting. Would it have worked? You know, I just, you don't know. I mean, Spock's big shoes to fill.
That's definitely true. But maybe it's one of those scenarios where since they got someone in there who, like, was not aware of the situation, you know, he might have been not intimidated by it, you know, and would have been able to step up because he was basically oblivious to what was going on. You know?
And I think also the character seems different enough in the way that Data is different enough that you're not just going to say, oh, well, he's just a, you know, a ripoff. And a not so good version. You know, he's a lot younger. There's more a different kind of comedy from him than there is from Spock. He doesn't have that kind of divided self kind of thing going on. I think it just comes down to, and he's got Gene Roddenberry to guide him as well. I think that's the other thing, which, you know, not many people have had since sort of 1988, 1989. So, you know, I think there's every chance that they might have pulled it off. But who knows? You know, that's the great unanswered question of this TV show.
So it seems like, you know, hearing this and then also, you know, just sort of other things that we know about it, there was like a lot of what would become, especially early Next Gen, in this concept. And it's weird because, I mean, I don't know. I always just think about it sort of like, even like aesthetically and stuff like that, like how would it be different from these shows? But I mean, there's obviously kind of like a shift in Roddenberry's, you know, worldview. People often talk about how like Kirk was Roddenberry in the 60s and Picard is Roddenberry in the 80s, you know, that sort of thing. And I'm just wondering, like, tonally, I mean, do you think it would have been more like the original series with that sort of action swashbuckling thing? Or do you think it would have been more pensive like Next Generation?
I think it would have been much more like the original series and potentially even more action oriented because they had a slightly bigger budget. They want action. They want drama. There's a lot still of, you know, they don't have that sort of Next Gen thing of all the shipbound shows. And you know, the older captain figure is Kirk. I mean, it's not like there's some kind of like really grown up, mature guy. I'm saying something about Kirk here. There isn't this kind of, you know, old wise kind of head on the captain particularly. He's still the kind of same inspirational action adventure ladies man, Kirk that we knew. But there is something going on which makes it more like Next Gen, which is that I think that Gene has had, by this point, I guess, nearly 10 years to think about why Star Trek has been successful. And he has some theories now that I don't think they had when they were making the show. So, you know, by 1973, I guess, I don't know, 72, 73, Star Trek is a phenomenon. And people keep saying to Gene, why? What is it about the show that's so great? And he has to actually kind of come up with answers. Whereas I think when they were making the show, they just wanted to make the best TV they could make. And there, you know, Gene wants to make things that mean something, that are about something, but he doesn't have this kind of fully worked out philosophy of the future. And you start to see in this TV show the beginnings of that, that his belief that they will always find a peaceful solution, and it's one of the things that keeps coming up in the memo, that they will be superior, that they will be more sorted than we are. But they bicker, you know, they tease one another, they have disagreements, Decker and Kirk. Have little shouting matches in some of the stories in which they're disagreeing about how to go about things. I mean, not, you know, they're not at one another's throats, But there isn't this kind of next-gen insistence that everybody gets on all the time and there's no real interpersonal conflict.
Okay, so in terms of the design and mm-hmm. everything, and the, visually speaking, I know that you've done a lot of research in terms of like what was going on with the art direction and everything, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know as much as I'd like to know. They tried to get Matt Jeffries back, but Matt was working on Little House on the Prairie, which was his absolute dream job, he told me. He said that was like, there was no way he was leaving Little House on the Prairie.
And my wife.
Yeah, well, Matt was having a great time. It was all the kind of stuff that he'd had as a kid when he was growing up, and he loved all that stuff. So Matt agreed to redesign the Enterprise. So there is, in fact, it quite often turns up as motion picture art, but there is actually a kind of a Matt Jeffries redesigned version of the Enterprise, which is kind of halfway house between the motion picture Enterprise and the original series Enterprise. It's got kind of, you know, he's flattened the nacelles, made them these kind of rectangular rather than round, I guess. And he's made some refinements to the shape of the body, but that is, and then he designs a shuttle, I think, as well. A new shuttle that's more kind of a bit more sort of Buck Rogers-y, a bit more, got a bit more budget to it. And that's kind of his contribution. He's like, well, that's all I can do for you because I'm having too much fun with Mike Landon doing Little House on the Prairie.
What was it? Was it going to be the same Enterprise, yeah, or was it?
No, absolutely. It's the same ship. Idea is that the Enterprise, I mean, the motion picture is adapted from the first script, from the pilot script.
Yeah.
So a lot of the story, if not the way the story is told, is the same for the opening, mm-hmm. you know, for the pilot. So the idea is that the ship's come back, it's gone into, it's had a refit, but that instead of Kirk being promoted to Admiral and, you know, given a desk job, he's going back on board the ship now, but he has a new first officer who is Decker. He has a couple of new crew members, so Zon and Ilea, and he's going back out there for his second 5-year mission.
So Matt Jeffries designed the exterior mm-hmm. of the ship and the shuttle, but what were they planning on doing in terms of the interior?
So Mike Minor comes on board to redesign the interiors, but they basically look the same. I mean, they're upgraded. Engineering gets quite a big boost. There are, again, on the director's edition of the motion picture, which is only on DVD because they didn't do it in a high enough resolution for Blu-ray, they've got the test footage of that. And I think it's also on the TNG season 3 DVD. And there's actually test footage shot in the new engineering, which kind of looks quite like the TNG engineering set, much more so than the motion picture engineering set. It's got a vertical warp core and walkways around it. And they've built some corridors and a bridge, which is kind of, I think, pretty much the same as the motion picture one, but just a bit less detailed. I think that they were able to, you know, they got a much bigger budget when it became the motion picture, and they were able to go in and upgrade all of that stuff. There are actually some shots from in the motion picture stuff where you can see people on the bridge of the Enterprise wearing original series uniforms, which I guess are just, there are only a handful of them. They're just kind of, lighting tests or I guess set tests. And they didn't have the new uniforms they were going to do for the motion picture at the time, but they had made new uniforms, which look like the original series uniforms for phase two, as we now call it. So it looks pretty much like a slightly kind of spruced up, I was going to say modern, but I guess it's 1978 modern version of the original series.
But the costumes, they pretty much kept almost exactly the same as they were.
That's my understanding. Yeah. There are references to green costumes in some of the in some of the scripts, and one in particular in Savage Syndrome. I'm never quite sure whether they just mean the gold teal ones and someone's got it, you know, misunderstood the color. I think there was also some talk about shifting the divisional colors around as well. So like on TNG, that, you know, that could be that people are wearing gold in engineering and red in whatever. But yes, I think they, as I understand it, they would have been pretty much, you know, slightly altered versions of the original series uniforms.
Interesting. It's such a weird thing because, I mean, you hear about this, you know, the pilot being the same story as motion picture, and you just kind of get this image in your mind, especially since motion picture feels very sort of like 70s and in its visuals. And the sort of contrast of like those sets with the sort of very 60s era uniforms, it's, I don't know, there's just something in my brain which has trouble.
The thing to remember that might help you a bit on that one is that the bridge set, all the sets actually, in Star Trek II are exactly the same sets as they are in the motion picture. They're just lit differently. I mean, they've got a new, you know, they've got a new coat of paint. They made the contrast a little more. And I think if you think about it looking like it does in Star Trek II, more than the way it looks in the motion picture, that's probably going to give you a slightly closer idea of what it would have looked like.
I guess that makes sense, yeah. Yeah, no, that's an interesting way to think about it for sure. Okay, so now let's get into the nitty-gritty here with these stories, because I think that's what people are really fascinated about. Now, you said that you've found a lot of the pitches and whatnot and a lot of the scripts which existed. What was there was the pilot, which was pretty much a version of the motion picture, you said, right?
Pretty much, yeah. So the pilot, which is called In Thy Image, is about V'ger coming back to Earth. It is different. There are a couple of different drafts of it. In the draft that I like the most, I guess, it's V'ger is actually not the probe that has been upgraded, but a ship from the machine planet that is bringing the probe back. One of the things I find slightly odd about a lot of these scripts is that they seem surprisingly like original series episodes. So, you know, I don't know where, I mean, I was only 10 when I went to see the motion picture, so I didn't think this, but, you know, when you go and see that, you kind of think, well, V'ger is Nomad, you know, it's the same story. And that kind of crops up a little bit in some of the other stories where you sort of think, well, actually, this is very like that episode or whatever. And I guess people didn't have Blu-rays or on-demand kind of stuff back then. So the chances of people having seen those episodes that were 10 years old was smaller, and people didn't worry about it in quite the same way.
Well, that's even kind of something that they did. It's the same studio and everything. Like with Mission Impossible, wasn't the pilot for that like an adaptation of one random episode of the show?
I don't know, but I wouldn't be surprised.
I mean, I think it seems like that was just kind of like the thing to do, you know? I don't know. I mean, they even do that in Next Gen with Naked Now, you know? Yeah. So there were a couple others which we've seen in some form or another, right? Yeah. Like The Child.
Yes, so there are two others. There's The Child and Devil's Due, which are both pulled out as episodes of TNG. The Child isn't altered very much, because the reason it was pulled out is because of the writer's strike and they were desperate to get something into development. So, I mean, Decker and Ilea and Riker and Troy are very similar characters in their conception. There's even a thing about in the writer's book for phase two, that Decker is a bit humorless and can be a bit of a martinet. And there's the thing when Jonathan always talks about with Riker that they told him not to smile. He was like told off for smiling throughout the first season of Next Gen. They're like, don't smile. So there are a lot of parallels. And Ilya also has these kind of vaguely defined telepathic powers that are like Troy. My favorite thing about Troy was Herb Wright, who was one of the most insane interviewees I ever had, was talking about how really difficult it was to work out what her mental powers were. And they said they just kept reducing them in every episode until it said he got it down to the level of a dog. You know, like the dog just goes, there's something wrong with this guy. And I think you have similar, you can see them sort of struggling with similar problems with Ilya. But yeah, so they're exact counterparts. And in The Child, you're just able to swap them out and to use that script. So it's pretty, pretty close. But what's a little unfair, I guess, is you have to remember that all the scripts that existed for Phase 2 were only kind of first drafts. You know, they would all have had a bit more work done on them. Apart from the pilot in The Image, which gets rewritten to become the motion picture. And I guess somewhere there will be Harold Livingston's draft of that script that is what they intended to do on the TV show before he and Gene tried to kill one another rewriting it for the motion picture. They really did try and kill one another. I mean, it was a bad, bad story.
But I imagine it's
yes, and one that you can never. Harold is so profane when giving you the story that it's impossible to ever repeat.
So Devil's Due was the other one, right? Which is kind of weird because that came like way later in Next Gen.
Yeah,
right?
I'm not quite sure why they pulled Devil's Due out. I know Ron always told me like by the time you got to episode 17 or 18 of a season, you were just like, what are we going to do? What can we do? There's nothing left. And they're all sitting there looking at some idea that Michael Piller had bought and going, I'm going to have to do that. They're going to give me that one. Oh God, please not that one. Please don't let me have the one where they get turned into kids. Oh God, they give me the one where they get turned into kids. So, you know, there's always this point in the season when they're a bit desperate to try and find stories. And I guess at some point they went back and looked through all these things that they owned. And Devil's Due seemed to be one that they could adapt reasonably easily.
How close to, I mean, to be fair, I don't really remember Devil's Due that tremendously well, but how close to it was?
I think it's reasonably close. I haven't reread it for a while, but it's a guy who's a con man rather than Ardra. It's probably, it feels more like an original series episode than the TNG version does. But yeah, I think in terms of the, you know, if you looked at the beat sheet, it's pretty similar. It's not a wildly different story.
So what were some of the other ones
The one, the really important one that would have changed everything is the Kitumba, which is the two-part Klingon story, written by John Meredith Lucas, who had been... briefly being the executive producer on season 2 of the original series. And he was, John Meredith Lucas was a great guy. He was a really talented writer and director. And they loved this script. Everybody, John Pogel told me that this one was might have been a first draft, but it was perfect as far as they were concerned. They didn't really plan to make major changes to it at all, just a few kind of little logic things. I did reread that one. Well, I reread the outline this morning, and it's a fantastic story. It's a really good story. And the idea is that the Klingons are going to declare war on the Federation, and a Klingon defector, I guess, comes into the Federation to tell them this news. And you discover that the Klingons is not actually the name of the race. The Klingons are the warrior caste of this society, which is divided into there's three castes and then a ruler. So there are the Klingons, who are the warriors, There are the technos who always explains how did the Klingons actually manage to get a working spacecraft and get out into space without just killing one another. So there was like a whole cast of scientists. And then there's a cast of, I think, what are they called? They're like citizens or something like that. They're not, they're the kind of the most looked down on people, but in a way, but they also have this much more luxurious life. And then at the head of all of this is there's a sort of ceremonial ruler who is the Kitumba, who has all the powers that he, political powers, that he doesn't actually exercise, and that there's the warlord who actually kind of runs the empire. And this sort of defector Klingon says that there is the warlord has managed to ramp up to the point of war, and that there's this new Kitumba who is only 17, and that the warlord is going to kind of bully him into approving the war, I guess. And that their only chance is to go deep into the heart of Klingon space and talk to the Kitumba, who lives on this kind of isolated planet with no defences, because it's so deep in Klingon space it doesn't need any, and persuade him that the warlord is making a mistake. And it's got a ton of stuff about Klingon culture, which is different. I mean, it's sort of feudal Japanese mixed with Sparta. There are lots of things that we'd recognise. They're quite keen to commit suicide, Klingons, in this thing. They can quite happily going and removing themselves, as they say, when things go wrong. But it's real attempt to explore Klingon culture and to try and get some understanding about them, and to come up with something that makes more sense than just, you know, the sort of moustache twirling bad guys, I guess, that they're worse than were in the original series. And if it had happened, everything would have been different. I mean, it just would have been, you know, it's just an extraordinarily interesting path not taken script.
That does sound cool. And that was a two-parter. Would it have, I mean, I guess spoilers for this thing, which didn't ever get made. would it have, like, changed the relationship between the Federation and the Klingons?
Yes. It ends with, I mean, they, you know, surprise, surprise, they managed to get to the Kitumba, and they managed to persuade him that he should call off the war. But he doesn't suddenly become like, oh yeah, okay, now we're going to be friends of the Federation. He's like, okay, well, you know, the reason we're not going to war is because we might lose at the moment, but give us 10 or 20 years and maybe we'll win. So I'm not just like your friend now. We might end up being friends. I realize that you're much more honorable than I thought you would be. Honor is already a big thing for the Klingons in there. So it's... It puts them on a different footing, a much more, I mean, this again goes to Gene's belief in optimism and things being good, and, you know, things will get better. But yes, it would have put things in a different place. But I think they were pretty clear they still wanted to keep the Klingons around as the big villains. Interestingly, the Romulans are in that story as well. They wanted to sort of obviously restore the Romulans as villains, so they turn up in quite a few of the stories, actually, rarely in a like a major way. They're just the kind of like the threat in the background.
That's interesting. Yeah, man, that sounds really cool.
What else? There are some really interesting sounding ones that they were obviously struggling with how to do. So there's one when Decker builds a machine that he falls into, which seems a little strange, but it takes him into a two-dimensional place. So he is stuck in a parallel dimension where there are only two dimensions. And they chase him in there. And it's just, I mean, it's a crazy, crazy idea, and it's crazy outline, but it's so kind of high concept science fiction. There's a thing where there are like people from this two-dimensional dimension, if there's such a thing, are kind of walking around the ship, and they you can only see them from a certain angle, But that was one of Gene's problems, was saying, well, which angle would it be if they're only two-dimensional? That's really kind of high concept science fiction. There's one that sort of really reeks of Trelane. There's one when they find an alien who is obsessed by sort of 19th century English novels and has decided to call himself Lord Bobby. Is like this kind of 1890s kind of gent. But though actually they had problems with that one. I mean, this is the thing that's fascinating about this, is that you don't get to see that many kind of like, here is the finished script, because they were still working on these things, and there are people suggesting, why don't we do this with the story instead, or do that? And there's one when they have this novel way of, that same story evolves upon, where they have that novel way of dealing with mental health problems, where they brainwash you into thinking you're a member of another species and put you down on a planet where you will just be able to kind of like live the life of the other people, and that will kind of cure you. And he gets pulled up for that same story. There's one where the kind of the ancient ones, you know, that the who turn up quite regularly, are kind of mentioned in the original series, but we never actually, you know, find out what their society was like. There's like a thing when
the Lovecraftian,
you know, in like Rook and Andrea were made by the ancient ones. There's this kind of, okay, you know, there are hints in the original series of some kind of lost civilization that existed in the distant past. They encounter this planet where they've kind of all been digitized, and they try to take over, the Enterprise crew, or turn them into them. It's a little bit confused, I guess, because again, it's not finished. I think that's a Norman Spenrad story. I mean, this is the other thing. So all these stories, they're written by, you know, you've got John Meredith Lucas, you've got Norman Spenrad, you've got Jerome Bixby, Simon Winselberg. You know, a lot of these are coming from people who wrote for the original Star Trek, and they're coming back, and it is kind of, you know, like I said, it's season four. What else is there? There's one.
Well, just kind of like jumping in there, was it kind of, because I know that like TV was at least starting to change in the way that it, you know, it constructed its writers' rooms and whatnot. Was it still kind of like the original series, where there might have been like three guys and then the rest of it was just sort of like freelance people coming
in? Yeah, it's exactly like that. So, okay. All right. So if you think of the original series and you kind of famously think of it as being Gene Coon, that is now Harold Livingston. Then there's a story editor. So Dorothy, for a large part of the original series, we think of as the main story editor. That would have been John Pogel. And then you've got Gene at the top of the tree, you know, not necessarily doing a massive amount on each individual script, but setting the tone and the direction and you know, approving the scripts rewriting some of them. It's very much that. And they are... they're just getting these writers into pitch, and that, you know, all these pitches are, it's interesting, all dated. So I was trying to kind of piece together a timeline of when things evolve, but you realize that some people know some things and other people know other things. It kind of depends, I guess, when they had a phone call or a meeting or whatever. So some people have Decker as Decker, and some people have him as Adams, even though their things dated like a month later. So I guess it's a question of when, you know, when they actually, manage the talk and we're working on this stuff.
It's crazy. I mean, yeah, there's so much going on here, and I know that we're running out of time, but I mean, like, what to you is kind of like the standout of this show in terms of like what it would have, I mean, as a Star Trek fan, I'm having trouble phrasing this question, but as a Star Trek fan, like, what do you think this show would have been like as a viewer, like in relation to the rest of the franchise? I mean, like, how do you think this would have changed what had come later?
I think it's, you know, I guess the thing is, it's actually much more likely outcome than what happened. You know, for someone to sort of come and take this failed TV series, which was how they looked at it, I guess, and go and make this enormously expensive movie, and I have lots of reasons I can tell you about why the motion picture is so expensive, and one of them is that it carries all the costs of the development for this TV show. That all gets billed to the motion picture, which is why it suddenly costs so much. There are other reasons why it costs so much. But it feels like it would have worked. I know, you know, Judy and Gar wrote their book about it, and they were like, kind of, oh, it's just as well it didn't happen because it would have been naff Star Trek in the 70s. And you know what? It's not. You read those scripts, it's not like people, like, I mean, I remember, you know, there are episodes of Space 1999 where it's like Peter Bowles and a pair of flares walking down a corridor in slow motion, and you just kind of think, oh, what? It's not like that. It is like season four. It's what maybe season three should have been. You know, it feels like proper Star Trek. Of the 17 pitches that I've read, there are probably four or five really standout episodes, ones that you think that would have been great. I would love to have seen this. And in fact, some of them you think, and they still haven't made that one, like the two-dimensional one, they still haven't done that. It's like, oh, you should do that.
Yeah.
You know, we should drop a line to Alex Kurtzman. But so it, you know, it's promising. It feels like I think it would have worked. I don't know how many years it would have run for. But if you think one of the reasons the Next Gen was this huge success is because there wasn't anything else, you know, there just wasn't any good intelligent sci-fi on TV, and this would have been that. So you know, how many years would it have lasted? Maybe 4, 5, 6 years of this, and Star Trek then wouldn't have been 3 seasons, would have been 9 seasons, and Spock would only have been in the first 3.
And then what do you think? I mean, obviously this is pure speculation, but let's just say, as someone who knows a ton about the history of Star Trek, this thing gets made instead of motion picture, and it goes on for, you know, let's say 5 seasons. Then, so what, we're at like 1982 now,
yeah,
or something
like
that.
Yeah. No TJ Hooker. What? That's what it means. Oh.
No TJ Hooker. Oh, no. Well, I'm glad this didn't happen. But then what happens next for Star Trek? I mean, with it being at that point in 1982, what's the next logical step?
Well, I guess at some point, someone would probably have made a movie.
Yeah.
But whether they would have put Shatner in it, I don't know. I think maybe... Yeah,
maybe it would have just been like a Decker movie?
No, I just think they might not have taken the people who were in the TV show. I think that you might have had Kirk and Spock and McCoy, but it would have been like the JJ reboot, you know, that they would have cast... God knows who they would have cast. Like, what, let's say it gets to 1986 or 1987. Maybe Tom Cruise makes Star Trek instead of Mission Impossible.
There you go.
I mean, I kind of think that's what Hollywood would have done. You know, I mean, the other thing that might have happened is that there might have been another Star Trek TV show a few years later. You know, maybe there would have been an equivalent of Next Gen without there being the movies. I mean, so much depends on how successful the TV show would have been. And that's, you know, there, like I said, if David Gautreau turned out to be great, if he turned out to be brilliant, maybe we would all love Zon more than we love Spock. It's hard to imagine, but it could have happened. It would have turned it back into a TV show, I think. I guess at some point, I mean, now every TV show you've ever seen gets made into a movie. I mean, you know, I don't know if you saw, but this morning, you know, Netflix or Amazon are making Lost in Space TV show again. That's my cat making all that noise.
That's okay.
So I guess Star Trek would eventually have got there into the same kind of place, but it would have been very different, I think. And I guess also Gene's philosophy might have evolved in a different way if the show had been on air. I think you know, his sort of complete devotion to a kind of pacifist future happened wasn't there in this show. You know, this is still a pretty military organization, Starfleet. And by the time you get to TNG, Gene's like, no, it's not a military organization at all. You know, he's constantly complaining about the military nature of the movies. So we would have had a more red-blooded Star Trek, I guess. Kirk still, you know, meets a girl in most of these episodes. so that's what's fascinating about it, is this moment in time, this kind of branch when it could have just gone off in this completely different direction, and then they made Star Wars, you know, changed everything.
It's fascinating. Thank you very much for, you know, sort of giving us this glimpse of this alternate reality. It's a very Star Trek thing to do.
Absolutely. Yeah, and it is a parallel reality, this show. I mean, it's, you know, and there's just enough. There are these little glimpses of things that just give you a hint of what it would have been like. And like I said, there are actually, you know, they commissioned 13 scripts. There are 17 or 18 episodes there are pitches for. There are designs for the Enterprise. There are, you know, there's a lot.
Yeah. It's crazy because it's not just like, oh, this guy wrote a script or this guy was, you know, it's like almost a fully formed show that they just didn't shoot.
Yeah, and they paid the actors. You know this, that they paid the actors for like 3 years to not do anything else? So they're like, that's one of the reasons that Leonard didn't want to do it. They just keep paying me to not do be in things, you know. It's like, I just want to go and work. But yeah, everybody else was like on a contract to not do things. And I think I have to remember, I'd have to look through my notes. I think Persis Kambata was actually cast for the TV show.
I think you're right about that.
Not for the movie. Yeah. So I know Decker wasn't. And I know, you know, I don't know if I told you this or whether you know this anyway. You know that, and I've forgotten his surname, Garrick. Andy Robinson was down to the last two for Decker.
Yeah. Really?
So it was him and Stephen Collins. And this is a movie by this point. They've already decided it's a movie. They hadn't cast Decker. I actually had the bizarre experience of getting to tell Andy why he didn't get the role 25 years later. He's like, no one ever tells you this. You never find out. They just say no. And it's because he wasn't blonde haired and blue eyed enough. And they wanted Decker to be very kind of, you know, very square jawed and obvious kind of hero, and Andy would have given it a little more of a twist, I think, as he said.
I mean, I guess at that point he was kind of known as like the Zodiac.
Yeah, he's
killer,
the psycho,
right?
From the Dirty Harry film. Yeah.
So yeah, not quite the same image they were looking for, but
yeah, well, he was a young, good looking guy. He had square jaw, but you know, he's, I guess Stephen Collins was very blonde and very blue-eyed. So.
Overly.
Yeah. So blue-eyed, you know, apparently they told me that his they couldn't do blue screen with him because his eyes disappeared.
Really?
Yeah. It was a
That's
real
fantastic.
Problem.
That's freaky. Yeah. That's freaky. Yeah. Well, thank you very much for joining us. It's been fascinating. I mean, we could talk for another, you know, like two
hours. Yeah, well,
there
are 13 scripts if you want to go through them one by one.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
It's all right for now.
But, that would be awesome. But
we have people you're going to have to talk to.
Yes. We're leaving this show, but there are other people who are, you know, picking up our show is entering phase two. Okay. So believe me, there's going to be people to talk to about this for sure. But in the meantime, where can people find you? Now you've got your Starship Collections thing, which is
still going strong. Yeah. We're doing the I've got the Doug Drexler's NX-01.5.
I've been told to ask about that. When is that?
When is it coming out? You know what? I never actually know. This is terrible. My schedule, as far as I'm concerned, the schedule ends once it leaves my hands, and then I kind of know it's like 7 or 8 weeks later that it gets into stores. I'm pretty sure it's February in the UK. And it normally is about 6 or 7 weeks behind that in the US. So I literally have, there are three of them in the world at the moment, and they're not quite right. So I have one on my mantelpiece, which I'm looking at right now. And John at CBS has another one, and then there's one back in the office. So that's happening. The regular ships are cranking out. I finally gave up on finding CG models for some of the things, like all the CG models for Insurrection just got lost. And they were in incompatible file format and no one could open them anyway. But fortunately we have good enough reference that we've been able to rebuild those. So they're on the way. I have three ships from Star Trek Beyond, which I can't tell you anything about, but I have them.
Excellent.
Three. I'm not saying there are only three ships in the film. I'm just saying I have three ships.
All right.
But we're aiming to get those out as close to the date of the movie as possible. I have been putting in questions to CBS about how soon there might be something available for the new show.
Has there been any thought to maybe doing, I know this is kind of outside the realm, but maybe doing like that design from Star Trek Phase 2?
I really want to do that.
Yeah.
It feels like, I guess doing Doug's NX refit is kind of like open the door to that we can do ships that aren't quite canon. And I do really want to do the Matt Jeffries Enterprise. But at the moment, you know, we're kind of overburdened with specials. We've got an embarrassment of riches, and I kind of would like it to be a special. But we might do it in the regular run. It kind of depends how many there are, really, and that depends on how many, you know, how long people keep buying them. So, but yeah, I do really want to do it. But I kind of worry sometimes. The problem with this job is you don't want to just do what you want to do. You want to do things that other people want to.
Sure.
Just have to hope.
But I mean, it seems like, I mean, I've heard a lot of people talking about the NX-01, you know, refit and everything. It seems like there definitely is a desire for stuff like that.
Yeah, I don't have any ships. I mean, I'll be honest. I've only ever seen ships. I've seen a couple in a store, and I saw, I found an office at the base where I work at who had like 30 of them. Mm-hmm. And I was like, kept wanting to touch him, but he wasn't there. But like, I want this NX-01.5 so bad.
Well, yeah, we could probably arrange something. I mean, it's an interesting thing. I mean, you don't know whether the people who really, really want it are the same people who are buying the rest of the collection. There's definitely a group of people who really, really want it. There was definitely a group of people who really, really wanted shuttles, which, you know, we've done some of now. You just have to sort of take your best guess and sort of go, okay, this is what I think people will want. But it's, you know, you set some rules up. At the beginning, you sort of say, well, we're only going to do canon ships. We're only going to do things that have been seen on screen. And, you know, there are plenty of them. So you don't, you know, that's what we're going to do. And then you start making exceptions. And, you know, there are a lot of people who are lobbying for the Titan or the Aventine. Actually, I think we are going to do the Titan because 5,000 people did sign the petition. So we are going to do it. One of the things I need to sort out when I go back to work next week. I'm wary of all of that kind of that pushing at the edges of what we do too much. An Enterprise designed by Matt Jeffries, there are only that's two of those. So.
Or like the Macquarie Enterprise.
Oh, well, that's canon. That
right, because it's in the background of three.
Debris field in the best of both worlds. Two versions of that. So that might be on my list.
You guys have done so many, you know, I mean, there's so many like random obscure ships.
Oh, we haven't even done the random obscure ships.
I mean, you know, and it's like, I don't even know what that is. You know, it seems to me that like, you've gotten to a point now where you have a large enough fleet that, you know, you can start making these exceptions. Yeah. And I don't think anyone will complain. You know, I think people will be excited. I would be excited.
There are a couple of the other one that falls into this kind of category is the Daedalus class, which is just about canon because Sisko had a model in his office.
Okay.
And the ring ship. That, you know, the ring ship Enterprise, which is in the on the Rakdak in the motion picture, which I guess makes it canon. There's a model.
We never actually
see the ship. So there's
a model of it in Into Darkness.
Yes, that's true. Yeah. So yeah, those are the ones that, you know, we now start to think about. I mean, I'm keen to alternate Fed ships with alien ships. I mean, I kind of, you know, stretch a point and include Vulcan ships in the Fed ships. And there are some things that we're doing that I'm very excited about that never existed in CG before, particularly in the Vulcan line of things. One of which might have been in the motion picture. One of which was in the motion picture. But yeah, we're still having fun with that. There's still, you know, there's more, and we're talking about what else we can do with Star Trek that people would want. So we continue to look at stuff, but there's a lot we can do, I think. And obviously, I you know, beyond hearing some quite enthused voices from inside CBS about the new show, that's obviously something that I don't know anything about yet. Obviously I have high hopes for and you know, would very much like it to be a success. And I think it's very relevant to phase two as well, actually, because that's like, it's a very similar situation someone was in, that you're trying to reinvent Star Trek. And I think they should put Zon in phase two and in the new show. That's what they should do. They should put Zon in the new show. And in fact, I think David Gaucho is still available. he wouldn't be a young man anymore, but you know,
yeah, doesn't matter.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah.
Well, they should have, you know, there are the one thing I think that Gene was brilliant. That was casting. And I kind of think, well, you know, this guy was cast as a Vulcan by Gene Roddenberry, and that's got to count for something.
Oh yeah, for sure. All right. Well, where else can people find you, like on the internet?
I tweet still. I tweet pictures of the ships. I think that's where there are NX-01 refit pictures out there now, and that's because I tweeted them. My Twitter is Ben C.S. Robinson. And then obviously the Facebook page for the Star Trek ships is there. We have our own Hero Collector website, which in fact, one of the big pushes for the next year for me is going to be building that up and trying to do more in the way of online features on that. So I'm going to be contacting a lot of my friends. And one of the extraordinary things about Star Trek is how everyone's moved on to work on something else. You know, and at one point, I think I looked around and realized that I knew 5 people who were running TV shows in America because they'd all started on Star Trek, you know. Which is an extraordinary thing, you know, that Star Trek ends up ruling the world. You know, there are a lot of people out there. So I'll be pulling in a lot of my contacts on that, and we'll be looking for content for that as well from people. So that should be interesting. I'll let you know a little more when we get there.
Excellent.
Okay. I'm where I was, basically. I continue to be there.
All right. Well, cool. Well, I mean, I know, I think I speak for everyone, you know, here at the network when I say, like, keep up the good work on those ships. They're amazing.
Well, thank you.
And thank you so much for talking to us about Phase 2 today, or Star Trek 2, or Star Trek, or whatever you want to call it. It's been fascinating.
Yeah.
I mean, even though we're not going to be here, you're more than welcome to come back anytime. I'm going to say that for
It'll be a pleasure. I enjoy this. As you can tell, I quite like to talk. So,
it's great.
I'm more than happy to talk. I know this is you've touched on a few of my passions, but there are many, many more. There's a lot more Star Trek stuff I can talk about until people stop me.
Excellent. Well, thanks again.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that was fun talking with Ben Robinson today. He gave us a lot of information that I didn't know, and teased other information that we probably shouldn't know.
Yeah, no, it was a lot of fun. You know, there's always, you know, just we talk about it a lot here, but the Star Trek that never was, you know, and Phase Two or whatever you want to call it is sort of like the ultimate in terms of that, you know, because it was like a whole series and it almost happened, like it came like really freaking close to happening, you know. So mm-hmm. I mean, that's pretty awesome and it's exciting. And I would love to hear what else was involved with that show, you know. It's just so much stuff. It's,
yeah.
It's great getting that sort of inside look at what would have been.
Yeah. But Phase 2 is not the only thing we've been talking about on Trek FM this week. So here's a quick look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
They just happened to come at just the right time.
Right,
or just
the
wrong
right
time
for it to be dangerous.
Like, literally, like, not even, like, that day, but, like 2 minutes before this happens.
The Ready Room.
Here's one more thing I want to throw out here for you guys. Recasting this episode, because I know you guys like to do this on To the Journey with things, with mm-hmm. series and such. I think that Ma'ab should be played by Will Ferrell.
To the journey!
Bravo to the holodeck.
Bravo to the holodeck. Bravo to science!
Yes, for coming to the truth.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
It's like, yeah, that's, I mean, commentary, Trek Stars. We can say that's, you see, it's a commentary on Trek Star. No, it's because our other show is called Commentary Track Stars, okay? And we were being cute.
The 602 Club.
I had a real fear when they first introduced that character that she was going to be the opposite of what you had just described, Matthew, that she would be too young for Bond, that she would be a little wet behind the ears, that we were going to fall back into all these cliches that I thought we had just broken by having the Monica Bellucci character there. But I was so relieved that they constructed somebody who had a lot of depth.
Women at Warp.
So we went in and pitched, and I have to say that was one of the most terrifying experiences of my life. I have scrubbed in on brain surgery. It did not frighten me as much as waiting outside Gene Roddenberry's office getting ready to go in and pitch to him.
Meta Trex.
That would have just been a grand moment if, you know, George Takei would have played Tuvix, you know, and when the transporter accident happens, he's standing there in those colorful clothes and just says, oh my.
Oh my.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out these shows and get in on the Daily Trek Talk. You'll find them on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, or you can just stream from the website. You can visit Trek.fm/podcast to get all the links. Mike, I understand that we have a voicemail.
Yes, we do. It's from Brandon. Not my
not your Brandon,
but
oh, okay.
Yeah, the Babel Conference is Brandon.
Okay.
So here, hey, have a listen.
This is a message for the guys at Standard Orbit. I just wanted to wish you a fond farewell and thank you guys for such a wonderful program. Everybody out there that listens to Trek FM is going to miss you guys very much. And I just wanted to thank you for having such an informative program that covered all aspects of Star Trek. And thank you for your wonderful episodes with Mark Cushman. It's been an absolute joy listening to you guys. And as for your last email contact you got from a listener, I don't think your guys' show was too slow. I think it was the perfect speed, and I love being able to hear both of you guys talk at all times. So congratulations on a wonderful run of 110 episodes, and I look forward to listening to more stuff from you guys in the future. So live long and prosper. It is the will of Landrew. P.S. Drew, you have the greatest laugh in the world. P.S.S. Michael, I love the Lost World.
That's pretty great.
Thank you very much, Brandon. I know that Drew appreciates that you appreciate his laugh, and I definitely appreciate that you appreciate The Lost World, because
no
that movie
does,
is a masterpiece, and I don't care if it's not true that no one else does. They're coming out of the woodwork. It was always me and my friend Josh, okay? Because Josh was always like, yeah, Jurassic Park, that was good. And then like he'd watch it more and more and he's like, you know what? This movie isn't really that good. And then Lost World came out And both of us were like, this movie is the bomb. And no one else thought that. No one else. Except for, you know, what I discovered? Marcelo from the Talk Film Society. He loves The Lost World almost as much as me.
It's like we've got this litmus test now. And, like, you are leading this mutant underground or something of Lost World lovers. I don't.
all the cool kids love
or
the
like
Lost
are you
World.
The next generation? You're either, you know, the outcast society, or you're like the, you are the Brotherhood of Mutants. You're the next generation.
It's just one of those things, you know. I have a feeling that this is going to be, you know, kind of like, I mean, there's a lot of movies which are like this, where, you know, no one appreciates them when they first come out. And then, you know, as time passes, people realize the brilliance of them. And I think The Lost World is one of those movies. And I'm just proud to say that I was ahead of the curve on this one, you know, and I loved it since I saw it, you know, the day after it came out at McClure Court. And I always will. I really want to do a commentary for it, just a solo commentary where, you know, I can talk about why it is so great.
Yeah, I would be interested. I would rent the movie and sync it up for that. But I've not done that.
You might as well just buy the movie, because after you hear what I have to say about it, you're going to be like, oh my God, he's right. I need to own it.
They do make 4-packs now. I was impressed. Like, immediate, the Ultimate Collection now includes Jurassic World, whatever it's called. The Lost Jurassic World.
Yeah, that's two movies too many, as far as Jurassic Park movies are concerned. You know, you don't need 4 movies. You just need 2.
Yeah, you just need 1. So, if you want to leave feedback like Brandon, not Mike's Brandon did, you can
go to speakpipe.com/trekfm.
Really?
And leave us a voicemail there.
Oh, cool. You can also go to trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. Choose send a show and choose standard orbit. That'll come to both of us by email. You can also find us on the Facebook group, The Babel Conference. And you can find the Trek FM Facebook page at facebook.com/trekfm. And on Twitter, also under username trekfm. Mike, where can people find you outside of Trek FM or on Trek FM, as your case is?
On Trek FM, you can find me doing commentary Trek Stars with John. Right now, we're in the middle of our look at Simon Pegg's work as a writer. We just did Hot Fuzz last week. You can find that episode now. And on Friday, you will be able to find our episode on Run, Fat Boy, Run. And you can find me on commentarytrackstars.com doing commentary Trackstar Babies. And you can find me on Twitter at Mumbles3K.
And you can find me on Twitter at 005, DUBLEOFIVE, and in various other places around the internet. Before we go, we'd like to ask everyone to please support our sponsor, who helps bring Standard Orbit to you each week, and our sponsor for the show is Audible.com. Audible is a great way for you to read all the books you've always wanted to read but never thought you'd have time for. Audible is the premier source for audiobooks with more than 150,000 titles to choose from, and new titles coming every week. From classics to current bestsellers, and even some of the most famous Star Trek books like Prime Directive and Federation, Audible has something for everyone. And Mike, I have something for everyone.
Oh, cool.
It's called Star Trek Into Darkness, Star Trek Movie Novelizations Book 2.
Interesting.
It's written by Alan Dean Foster, narrated by Alice Eve. It runs for 8 hours and 55 minutes, and it's unabridged.
Excellent.
The summary is... the official movie tie-in novelization of the highly anticipated sequel to 2009's blockbuster feature film Star Trek. Pioneering director J.J. Abrams has delivered an explosive action thriller that takes Star Trek into darkness. When the crew of the Enterprise is called back home, they find an unstoppable force of terror from within their own organization has detonated the fleet and everything it stands for, leaving our world in a state of crisis. With a personal score to settle, Captain Kirk leads a manhunt to a war zone world to capture a one-man weapon of mass destruction. As our heroes are propelled into an epic chess game of life and death, love will be challenged, friendships will be torn apart, and sacrifices must be made for the only family Kirk has left, his crew.
Sounds good.
I think that is worthwhile. and, yeah, and should be listened to just for the description alone.
Especially since you can get it for free on audible.com.
That's right. As a Trek FM listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice along with a 30-day trial just to see how great Audible is. So give it a try today, catch up on all those classic Star Trek books you've had to read, and that latest novel from your favorite author as well. Just go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up today. Again, that's audibletrial.com/trekfm, and we thank Audible for supporting Standard Orbit and Trek FM.
Hey, there's another way that you can support us, which
what?
I think is pretty cool.
What's that?
That's by buying some swag from the store, the new Trek FM store.
You got stuff already.
I got a hoodie. I got a Trek FM hoodie.
It looks so cool.
It's pretty awesome. Yeah. But you can get other things, too. So you can get things which are specific to Standard Orbit. You can get...
I know! Ninja Cat!
A Ninja Cat thing. And you can also get a Maroon Monster t-shirt.
Yeah, show your team pride.
Or a sweatshirt or whatever. Did you get anything yet?
No, I haven't.
Oh, my God. It's cool. I'm debating. You see, it's gotten to the point now where I'm like, what do I get? You know? Do I get a t-shirt? Because we're going into the middle of winter now. So I'm not going to be able to wear t-shirts, right?
Right.
And like, what kind of t-shirt? What color? What size? Because their size is all like wonky.
Oh, great.
No, because like they have like different brand, like, and
right,
and,
right.
You know, like it's they're like, buy two sizes too big for the sweatshirts, for the hoodie. In order, you know, and it's like, wait, no, that, no, well, okay, it kind of works that way, sort of, I don't know.
So where's that at?
It's trekfm.link/trekfmstore.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
You can trekfm.link/trekfmstore.
Yes.
And there's That's a cool, I like the word Enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
Not the word Enterprise. It's an Enterprise shape with a bunch of words in it. It looks like a cloud tag cloud.
Yeah.
But it's got, like, it says Standard Orbit and all the show names and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There's some cool stuff, and hopefully more to come. If there's anything that you want to see, you know, they're asking people. They want people to let them know what you want to see so that they can, you know, get on that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've been campaigning hard for a Citizen Kane of Star Trek t-shirt. So we'll see. Let them know that you want that, for sure. And get a Maroon Monster shirt or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
Do you get like the 3/4 sleeve, like the baseball jersey with the Maroon Monster thing? I just don't know. Or like hoodie, like I don't know.
Find out what kind of combinations you can make there at trekfm.link/trekfmstore. We'd like to thank Richard Rutledge Jr. and Renee Roberts for being our associate producers this week by supporting us on Patreon. You can find Richard on Twitter at RUT8972 and Renee at MRES_1701.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
And if you want to help them help us keep us in orbit, you can support us on Patreon. If you go to patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find a list of donation levels where you can get things like exclusive digital goodies, early access to episodes, access to our project manager, previews, all kinds of crazy stuff. Or you could be listed as associate producers, and you could be listed as associate producer, like Renee and Richard.
Yeah.
You'll find out where the donations can go on the site, things like covering the monthly cost of hosting and distribution, hiring an editor, upgrading our equipment, other cool stuff. Again, that's patreon.com/trekfm, so check it out. Next week, the final commentary.
Yeah, City on the Edge of Forever.
You better watch out, because it's right on the edge.
Yes.
It's right. You're going to fall over.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be great.
Oh, yeah.
Well, everybody, thanks for listening. Have a good week and keep on trekking. It is the will of Landrew.
Mr. Chekov, take us out of orbit. Ahead, warp factor 1.
Hi, sir.